You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day, I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions, because you know I told you, and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up to try to get in the game, because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a baller. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bone. He shattered the mold, and all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538's podcast about the week in sports narratives. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538. To my right, Neil Payne. Voice is back, Neil.
Just about. I'm like 90%, I'd say.
10% husk, 90% vibrancy. Right. Good. And fresh off a red eye, Kate Fagan. Fresh in from Canada, because that's her devotion to Hot Takedown.
That's right. Red eye from Edmonton.
Is that an easy red eye experience, Kate?
So few non-stops from Edmonton. In fact, none. So I went through Toronto.
Delightful.
Yeah.
How was Edmonton? You were there for the World Cup?
I was there for the World Cup for the U.S. match yesterday. Found a great coffee spot, so my life was good.
Excellent. We're going to talk about that shortly. So on today's show, nice segue, without even realizing it, Kate. On today's show, the U.S. women's national team are undefeated in the World Cup, but nobody seems all that happy about it. We'll try and fix the U.S. women's national team with Allison McCann, our resident soccer expert. We'll stop by as well. We'll talk about Neil's research into the most optimized suit for college basketball players to wear to the NBA draft. That's what that piece was about, right?
Oh, yeah, completely.
Cool. Fashion.
Good. We'll talk about the NBA
fashion
draft,
metrics.
Too, I suppose. Yeah. And we'll talk A-Rod's 3,000th hit and how I ended up waiting in line to get into Yankee Stadium while a ball arced its way into history.
Wait.
Had tickets to the game.
Aren't you a Met fan?
It's a long story. We don't even have to bore the listeners with it.
You were trying to get into Yankee Stadium?
No, I happen to have tickets to the game.
No, it's...
Oh, you're disowning me now? Oh, okay. Anyway, didn't see the home run. Would have liked to. Didn't happen. But first, before we get to all that, Kate, your call to action from last week was hurt. We had a conversation about whether the Chicago Blackhawks were a dynasty. They won their third championship in 6 years, and we were wondering whether or not a string of championships that's not a consecutive string of championships qualifies as a dynasty. And Kate, listen to yourself from last week. Go back into that time machine and what you said.
Okay.
Paleontological.
I would love if we could come up with something that's sort of in the vein of a political dynasty. Another word for a government that has maintained. Is there a word for a government that has gone out of power and then come back into power?
Ooh. So the tweets and emails came quickly. So Jeff M8. So first of all, listeners, thanks for all of your tweets. I'm only going to mention a few. They're all great. Jeff M8 tweeted all sorts of ideas. You guys ready?
Yeah.
Pseudo dynasty. I mean, it gets at it, but it's sort of maybe still too rooted in dynasty, in my opinion. But okay. Reign. Provisional. Repetitive evanescence, which is perhaps my favorite. Reappearing dominance. Subjugative redundancy.
Wow.
Subjugative? I may be saying that wrong. Redundancy. Robert from Alabama wrote, I couldn't believe in the talk about different words for dynasties, you nerds didn't come up with, quote, perennial powerhouse, a phrase reserved for teams that are almost dynasties or could have been dynasties that instead are always good but rarely, if ever, the best. And then our call for political doctoral students, Kate, was answered.
Yep.
By Stuart Prest of Vancouver. And he went with an interesting one. Hegemon. So I guess the Blackhawks would be a hegemon of the NHL. That, to me, though, implies that their style of play influences other teams' style. And is that what we're trying to get at with Dynasty, do you guys think?
No, we're not.
So you're still not satisfied, Kate?
No. I don't like it when we're using two words to come up with what we want, really just one powerful word.
Because we're replacing
hegemon,
a one-word term.
Yeah, but that's just going to go over too many people's heads because, like, right now, I even don't even know what we're talking about when we say that. So I just don't think we've yet landed on the word that is going to be not quite synonymous with dynasty. Like, these are all just too, like, repetitive evanescence. Although I adore that as a phrase, it's not really getting at the core of what we need.
Okay, so we still don't have the word, but...
The closest we got was Jody chiming in with... Either calling it like the Clintons, if Hillary does in fact come into power, or the Bushes, but that could be a little tricky.
But we do have perhaps a more accurate definition of dynasty in the modern era. Noah Schusterman, a historian teaching in China, we have listeners all the way across the world, said or wrote, for there to be a sports dynasty, I would propose two criteria. The first would be domination, and the second would be turnover during that domination. Mm-hmm. So his point was that dynastic rulers leave their power to their heirs, and that's what makes them dynasties. So maybe we've been going around about dynasties all wrong the whole time. He brought up the New York Yankees from the Ruth and Gehrig era through the DiMaggio era and the Mickey Mantle era as well.
Yeah, it seems like that's sort of the opposite of the way a lot of people think about, especially in the NBA, of a dynasty, because we keep the Chicago Bulls, for instance, as a dynasty because they had Jordan and Pippen throughout that entire six championship run, whereas we split up the Lakers of the 2000s because in one of them they had the very distinct Kobe-Shaq period, and in another one they had Kobe still, but then they had Pau Gasol, and that's seen as almost like two different, it's not a continuation of the same dynasty.
And you almost, according to this definition, you almost want there to be like a succession plan and not just like a break and then you get new people in. It's almost like if you look at the Spurs and if the big three come back and then they also pick up a good free agent and sort of blend the two. And
well,
then,
Kawhi Leonard ends up being their
yeah,
their
and if they get like LaMarcus Aldridge or some big free agent, you can kind of see the throne being passed. That would be more of a dynasty than, you know, some of the other, like the Lakers.
All right, so we're approaching an answer, but maybe don't quite have it. No, Kate's still unsatisfied. Listeners, keep tweeting, keep emailing. We're still reading. We're still listening. So, okay, let's get to the Women's World Cup, and let's bring in Allison McCann, our visual journalist at 538, for this conversation. Allison, welcome to the show.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me.
So on Monday night, the U.S. Women's National Team played a Colombia squad that had the lowest remaining WSPI in the competition at the time that they played. They didn't score. The U.S. didn't score any goals against them in the first half. They missed a penalty kick against a replacement keeper, and they lost two key players for their next match against China. Oh, and they won 2-0. Michelle Akers, a former midfielder for the American national team, is not happy. Here she is talking about U.S. coach Jill Ellis on SiriusXM FC 94.
If she's pleased with the way we played tonight, then what the hell is she doing coaching our U.S. team?
That's some heat. That's some hot
take
heat.
Even last night in the press room in Edmonton, pretty much immediately after she said that, you know, because it filled our timelines on Twitter, almost everybody in that press room, like all the U.S. writers, were like, "Did you all hear what Michelle Akers said?" Because we're just not used to people coming in that hot on women's sports in particular, and
especially
and
someone connected
team.
To the team yeah. in some way. Yeah,
and a lot of times because we obviously we have Julie Foudy, who does a lot of work for ESPN, and there's Brandi Chastain. She's pretty critical at times, but nobody has come in this hot and really just dropped the mic on it.
So before we get to the numbers that maybe prove or disprove Akers' take wrong or right, Allison, I want to get to the full list of complaints. What are diehard U.S. Women's National Team fans worried about for Ellis?
I couldn't agree with Akers more, and I know you just said she's a midfielder, but, you know, she's a Hall of Famer. She was the player of the tournament in the 91 World Cup, so, like, if anyone's going to come in with this take, it would be Michelle Akers, who played as an offensive center mid and knows that watching this team, there is no midfield right now. It's absolutely atrocious. In the last game, Jill had said something crazy like Holiday and Lloyd play as two sixes, which means two defensive center mids. And if you watch video from the Nigeria game, there is a giant gaping hole in our midfield. We do not have a defensive center mid, which basically means that those two midfielders are just getting stretched too wide or all over the place. And not being able to join in the attack and create chances offensively. So by virtue of not having a defensive center mid, we basically don't have offensive center mids. And I think that's sort of what Michelle Akers was alluding to, but being like, nobody that's not a casual soccer fan that's watching this thinks that we are playing well. I mean, we're winning, so it's hard to say we're not, you know, doing the job. And I think we'll continue to, you know, do fine against, you know, teams like Colombia and even China, but this is not going to hold up when we face Germany, France, Japan. It's pretty bad out there.
And Allison, you found numbers that suggested that our midfield is producing less than it did in the last World Cup, right?
Yeah. So I just looked briefly at how the combination in the 2011 World Cup, which was usually Heather O'Reilly, who has not played a minute in this tournament, Carly Lloyd, Shannon Box, and Megan Rapinoe, and their chances created were about 9.5 per game. And Box plays as a true defensive center mid, so that dynamic was a lot different. And Lauren Holiday was even playing as a sort of holding forward a 10 position in 2011. And now in 2015, our combination of in the last game, Heath, Lloyd, Holiday, and Rapinoe, their chances created were 5.4, so about half as many. And obviously, this is a different World Cup. You know, the teams are better. We would expect those numbers to not be the same, but to create twice as many chances in our last World Cup as this one, I think you have to say what's going on in the midfield.
So, yeah, and watching them, the biggest problem seems to be, and Allison, maybe you can speak to this, is that there's no real solution on the bench. No true players to fill those holes. It feels like the roster selections for this team have kind of left out some of the key players who might be able to step in and kind of play that sixth position that you're talking about, the number six position. Certainly seeing Heather O'Reilly would be a step in the right direction. Megan Rapinoe has been playing great. But when you have like two of the key U.S. players, Holiday and Lloyd, who could be very effective playing out of position and seemingly being way less effective than they could be, and you don't have a solution on the bench, it's just very concerning that you can't even say, like, oh, let's change our style of play, because I don't even know that the people on the bench are capable of stepping in and having the skill set that we need.
And so, especially, and Neil, you and I were tossing around numbers before this taping about possession in soccer. And one of the things about the U.S. and the way that they're playing, it seems to me, is that we're supposed to just be destroying teams, we being America. America's supposed to be destroying teams, and they're not doing it. Neil, when you looked at the teams that we played, Nigeria, Australia, Sweden, and then last night in Colombia, you saw that we aren't performing even as well as we should based on the differential between the quality of the two teams playing, right?
Yeah, just looking at this year's World Cup alone and looking at the soccer power index that Allison put together before the tournament started, you would expect there's like a really tight relationship between possession percentage and a team's SPI, meaning basically the more talented team usually controls the ball for, you know, more of the game, and you would expect that. And then the relationship kind of gets more noisy when you start looking at, like, does a team turn that possession into shooting and then turn the shots into goals? But I think one of the things that is concerning for the U.S. is not just that they're not really turning them into shots or goals, but they're also not possessing the ball as much as you would expect from a team given their SPI and the SPIs of their opponents. And especially since we talked going into the tournament that the U.S. was trying deliberately to play this very possession heavy style of play. And for instance, in the game against Colombia, they had a 58% possession rate. And if you looked at the power ratings of the teams, you would expect them to have a 63% possession rate. And that was sort of one of the more disappointing possession games of the whole tournament so far, not just for the U.S., but if you look at all the games, especially games involving really good teams.
And this seems to connect with what we were talking about last week with hockey, about possession really mattering because it's how your chances get created. And in hockey, it's how you prevent random things, the puck from bouncing a weird way. But in soccer, the more you possess the ball, the fewer chances your opposing team has to create chances. Now there's counterattacks in soccer. It's a bit different than hockey as well.
This seems like a timing thing to me. And Allison, I'd like to hear what you have to say about this, because it seems like we are in this, we the U.S., in this process of playing a better, more efficient possession style soccer, and but we're not there yet, and so we're caught in this weird space where maybe if it were 9 months from now and we'd had longer to work through the growing pains of switching some of these positions, we would get there. But now we're caught, like, maybe we would have been more effective just staying with the old style and playing it one more World Cup, and we're on this like weird in between. Do you feel that way at all?
Yeah, and I mean, I think we are sort of in this weird in-between, but sort of reverting back to the old style, because the lineup that we're giving, the players that Jill is choosing to put in are not sort of a possession-oriented style. We don't have a defensive center mid allowing Holiday and Lloyd, who I think, you know, Holiday especially is one of the best playmakers in women's soccer, you know, to do what she is good at. You know, she's not a defensive center mid that should be running back. And yeah, it is just very concerning because I agree, like you said, you know, these players that we've brought, I'm not suggesting we should put Shannon Box, who's pretty much our only defensive center mid, a 37-year-old who, you know, has hardly played in the past year. She just had a kid last year too. But like, that's all we've brought. We didn't bring any defensive center mids. And on Friday, we're without Holiday and we're without Rapinoe. And it's just, I don't know who is going to fill those holes effectively.
And the thing here is that we're kind of getting away with this kind of play and we're winning. But as one article that I read suggested today, it's like when we realize that it's not working and we're not up to par, we'll be eliminated. It's not like there's going to be time to be like, oh, this style of play isn't efficient enough. We're not playing at that highest level. It's like by the time we realize that, we're out of this tournament.
And that's where I think the critiques of Ellis do really register for me is, the thing about the World Cup, and we saw this with with Klinsmann for the Men's World Cup too, it's so hard to make adjustments mid-tournament because you have to set the rosters on the front end. And so as a result, it really is up to the coach to have a lineup that's flexible enough to adjust and adapt to what's happening on the field. And if you don't have a bench that can do that, then it is on the coach more than it's on the players.
And I've been in front of Abby Wambach three times now during this tournament where she has just hammered home the point that this roster is so flexible and that Jill Ellis at halftime has all the options in the world to tweak and change what she's seen in the first half to make up for it and change in the second half. And that actually seems to not be true at all. And the Achilles heel of this team seems to be that there aren't the right options on the bench. And yet their rhetoric is trying to convince themselves that they can fill any hole, they can solve any problem because they have all of this versatility on the roster.
But we haven't seen that yet. So, Allison, we need to wrap up in a second, but the next match is against China. It will be without Rapinoe, without Holiday. How should we feel? The WSBI, Neil, you were looking at before, suggests that we should beat them soundly. I think we're up like 10 or 15 points above China. But we are without these two players. So, Allison, is this the match where the U.S. could get its comeuppance, or is that going to come in the semifinals?
You know, I don't think it's going to come in this match against China, just based on I think we can get through with brute athleticism and some crosses turned into goals that Alex Morgan had yesterday. You know, we'll still get those. But so I think China will, you know, be fine game. But with Germany or France, who we would be likely to face next, there's just no way that we'll be able to do that. I liked this stat I grabbed before, too. We keep going back to this chances created, and I'll give you what the U.S. is. This tournament has been 37 chances created, and Germany's has been 85. So that threshold is quite different, and I think that, I don't know, if we don't figure it out in this next game, I would be more than shocked if we could play against Germany.
Perhaps the one silver lining will be, though, is that Jill Ellis is going to be forced, because of those cumulative yellow cards, to try some new players and change that lineup specifically in the midfield. And perhaps some new ideas will be sparked and we'll see some combinations and some rhythm will be created. Of course, you could say that it could completely implode because now we're doing completely different lineups, which has already been the problem. But maybe she'll find something in that midfield to go with going forward into the semis.
Okay, so let's leave it there for now. Allison, thanks for joining from Los Angeles. You'll be back at the end of the show for Significant Digits.
Thanks for having me, guys.
And now a message from our sponsor, which this week, as always, SeatGeek, the smartest way for fans to save money on sports tickets. Usually in this ad, I mention DealScore, SeatGeek's fancy algorithm that takes into account historical ticket prices and the magnitude of the event itself to tell you your potential ticket's DealScore. It helps you know whether you're getting a good price on your ticket, et cetera, et cetera. But this week, I have no DealScores to offer you people.
What?
Because I'm here to talk about the NBA draft. It's at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn this week, and it's an event so abnormal, SeatGeek doesn't have a DealScore for it. But it does have tickets, and those tickets, rather incredibly, are more valuable, according to SeatGeek's data, than all but three of the Brooklyn Nets home games this last season. Neil and Kate, can you guess which three games were more valuable than as tickets than the draft itself?
All of their games against the Cavs.
They had played one game against the Cavs at home.
Oh.
So tick that. Two others against the same team.
The Warriors.
Did they play the Warriors?
The Knicks. Come on.
The Battle of New York.
Rivalry.
The Subway Series.
Yeah, sure. So if you're going to the NBA draft or any other sporting event this summer, use our promo code TAKEDOWN and get a $20 rebate off your first SeatGeek purchase. Maybe that promo code will still be good when they play the Knicks next year.
Although a lot of promo codes are good for the Knicks.
Quite bad. That's promo code TAKEDOWN. The SeatGeek app is your ticket to sports this spring. Speaking of that draft, Thursday night, a bunch of amateurs will finally leave their unpaid internships and enter the working world. Because the NBA hasn't adopted Hot Takedown's brilliant plan to transform the NBA lottery by having teams bet on each other's future performance.
Yet,
exactly. And you listeners can listen to past podcasts to understand what we're talking about. So because that hasn't happened yet, the Minnesota Timberwolves are picking first. But who should they pick? Sharif Abdul-Rahim says it's tight, but it's Karl-Anthony Towns.
It's tough. It's really tough because, like you said, both of them have all-star potential. Both of them are big-time talents. Both of them similar games, can run, can score in the post. I think what it comes down to is Minnesota's front office looking at it and saying, which guy works best, complements what we have, Andrew Wiggins, Rubio, Zach LaVine, which one of these guys we see fitting with those guys best going forward? I think it's Towns.
I like the hard rock is the background to the hot take. So, Neil, you did a whole model along with the ESPN stats and info to figure out who the right choice as first pick was. Is Sharif Abdul-Rahim correct?
Is it okay that I don't have any hard rock going over the background?
Jody can cue it up for us.
Okay, they're going to add that in post. Okay, perfect. So we did a story, Zach Bradshaw of ESPN Stats and Information Group and I had this story earlier last week where we looked at basically which statistics predict who will have the best NBA career, specifically an early NBA career, because those are the years in which you have control of the player at a sub-market rate. And we looked at, we used an algorithm that tried to predict, you know, the odds of a player becoming a superstar, a starter, a role player, or a bust. And especially a bust was someone that was kind of a replacement level player, didn't play in the NBA. And as it turns out, after all of our metrics, Karl-Anthony Towns was pretty easily the number one overall player among college players in terms of prospects for this year's draft. And Okafor was not only just not number one, but he ranked number four according to our metric and was well behind Towns and was behind Justice Winslow, his teammate at Duke, and also Stanley Johnson of Arizona. So that's kind of the pecking order that the stats came up with when we ran our model, which seems to suggest that Towns has a lot more superstar potential and is kind of a franchise player that you could build a team around.
What do you think accounted for Okafor falling in your model?
So I think some of it is defense, and some of it is just like Towns is really good, and he shows up as being very versatile. He looks like a defensive monster, but he also has offensive skills. And Okafor is really good offensively, but I think there are questions about his defense, and even things like athleticism seem to be not on the same level as Towns.
So one of the things I was interested in your model was that just because a player has star potential doesn't mean they won't be a bust, according to how you did this. And so Karl-Anthony Towns isn't the player that has the lowest bust potential or percentage chance. Whereas D'Angelo Russell has a higher, from Ohio State, has a higher star potential.
Highest in the draft.
Highest in the draft even, but a huge bust potential. So how should teams make sense of that when they're picking? Do you go for a star, or do you go for a safe non-bust probability?
Yeah, I think it speaks to playing style. And for someone like Russell, he's a really awesome college scorer. And players like that you know, if their scoring translates to the NBA, then there's a pretty high probability that they'll become a superstar. But then if it doesn't translate, then they might not have as much to fall back on. And so it's harder to kind of carve out that niche as like a starter or a role player. Whereas if you're someone who has, you know, a lot of size, or if you have a very versatile skill set like Justice Winslow has by comparison, you're a safer pick, because even if your primary strength doesn't really translate to the NBA, and we're not great at predicting these things, there are things that he can kind of call upon as a calling card and still stick as a lesser player.
Well, it also seems like a direct correlation to real life, right? Because if you look at like even the engine of a car, as you go faster, you're closer to the red line. Yes, you can. You get to a really high mile per hour, you're also in danger of busting the engine. And that's what I think of when you talk about how all these guys who have huge upside also come with, at times, the potential to be bust, which is like a lot of things in life with risk reward. But the thing that I was really interested in about that model is that one of the key factors in predicting NBA success was the number or the rate that these guys were able to create two-point attempts on the floor. I guess I didn't think of the rate of creating attempts to be a direct correlation to NBA success as much as you would say like number of field goals made or you know, vertical or percent on field goal percentage. Just simply, but you can kind of see how just simply creating shots at the college level and being able to have that impact for your team would translate.
Yeah, and we talked a couple weeks ago about usage rate as this idea of, you know, what share of the offense runs through you. And we're talking about LeBron, I think, and we're marveling at, you know, LeBron had an unbelievable NBA Finals, even though he wasn't very efficient, because one of the leading indicators was that he had this huge usage rate that was like higher than anyone else in the history of basketball, as far as we can track the stat. So I think that's kind of the same thing that's going on here, where like the ability to create shots speaks a lot to your talent and your potential to sort of that you transcend the role that you played in college. For instance, if you had a, you know, sort of a small or tightly managed role and you really thrived in that role and were very efficient, it could just be that, you know, they could have plugged anyone into that role and he would have approximated a lot of the same efficiency stats. Whereas if you have a more integral role in the offense, then a lot of it is you making things happen yourself. And I think that is something that speaks to, you know, a lot of this NBA draft thing is trying to figure out what is portable about a player's numbers or about his profile from college to any number of destinations that he's going to end up in the pros, and a lot of it depends on how he can fit in and make the teammates around him better once he gets to a new situation.
And how much of it is about just like raw measurable athleticism? I mean, certainly that goes into the metric, like at vertical and height and weight and all those things we can measure. How much of that plays a factor?
Oh, I think, yeah, those are really correlated with each other. If you think about like two-point attempts, especially in college and the way the game is played now, where three-pointers are really run rampant in the college game, your ability to actually create consistent shots inside the arc seems to take on new meaning, because you're having to go amongst the tall trees and you're having to like actually make something happen. And it's not just catching and shooting, but you're having to use your athleticism to create things.
But what's interesting too is that the scouts seem to factor all of that into their own scout ranking. And I think when I was watching the NCAA tournament, I was using the eye test to say whether or not Okafor or Towns maybe was the better NBA player, right? I mean, I think whenever I watch an NCAA game, there's a couple moves, especially that big men will do, a post move, for example, where you're like, oh, that's an NBA move. He must be NBA ready or something.
It looks like it would work against NBA
exactly.
defenders.
And so what was interesting to me, Neil, is that the scouts do seem to be right, that when you look at the wins above replacement that these players had and correlate that to their scouting rank coming into their draft, the players that were ranked better from scouts produced more once they got to the NBA.
Yeah, the metric that we used to kind of be a proxy for scouting opinion was Chad Ford of ESPN.com, his top 100 ranking.
He's a scout hegemon, a scout dynasty,
yeah,
maybe.
a perennial powerhouse. And we had that going back to 2001, and so we kind of looked at that over time and how well that plus the stats predicted how well a player would play. And it turns out that the scouting ranking is by far the most predictive single measure that you could have about any given player. And, you know, there's a little bit of a question of how much of that is sort of cyclical, where, you know, do players get better opportunities to produce wins above replacement because they have the higher scouting ranking? Or do they have the higher scouting ranking because they have the better potential to be successful in the NBA? But even putting that aside, yeah, there's a pretty strong relationship between how the scouts see a guy's career playing out and how it actually plays out. But it is interesting, as you mentioned, Chad, that even after, you know, controlling for that and taking into account the scouts' opinions about players, that some of these other stats that you mentioned, Kate, are, you know, take on increased importance, and they're predictive on top of the scouts' rating, like your assist percentage and your 2-point shots per minute and offensive rebounding percentage, things like that, are perhaps not being properly priced into by the scouting ranking, even though they do a really good job overall of predicting.
Well, I think what the scouting ranking gets to, in a way, is also like the unmeasurable pieces of a guy's athleticism. Like we've talked about, like even if you look at Steph Curry in college, there's certain like core athletic metrics that you would say he falls short on. But when you watched him play at Davidson, you could see some sort of like internal rhythm that he possessed for the game that maybe you can't take and put it in a measurable athletic statistic. Whereas in a scouting report, you're going to take into account this kind of like this very subtle hand-eye coordination or rhythm or just feel for the game. And I think what it made me think of when we talked about taking into account scouting reports and how they're actually more accurate than you may think, because you're like, oh, human error, and these are just one man or woman's opinion. But I love the way Nate also uses top 25 preseason rankings in his NCAA tournament predictions, because a lot of that is just a vote from people who have watched college basketball and saw those teams all year, and then from the eye test are predicting them for the next year.
And based on the recruits that
they saw the recruits.
And that's all a lot of times eye test mixed with some other things, and it turns out to be a really key factor in the NCAA tournament.
So here's a question that I have about what an NBA general manager should do at the draft. I think when the NFL draft came around, we mentioned the Cade Massey system that tells you to get more draft picks in later rounds if you're not convinced of the top pick that you might make. Is that right, Neil? Am I making that?
Yeah, it was just saying that like NFL GMs sort of overrate their ability to pick the right player if they have the right to choose first. They think that they will almost certainly get the player that's going to have the best NFL career, but if you actually look at the numbers, the odds are much lower that they'll pick even if they have the right to choose.
So is there a Cade Massey for the NBA? You know, or is there some overarching system that we should be thinking
about? So what you're saying is that in the NFL, it's like lottery tickets, as we've talked about in the past. So get more picks and give yourself more of a chance.
Now, there are more players on
the
NFL roster. There are more rounds. Like, there's a very different
system. Does that translate to the NBA?
Yeah. Like, if I have the seventh pick and it's a 4-player draft, is it always wiser for me to trade down to get more picks, or rather to trade my pick into two medium assets?
Yeah, and it's worth saying that it's not totally like a lottery. In general, the top overall pick has a better career than like the 30th overall pick and so on and so forth. It's just that the slope of the value from going down from the first pick down to number, you know, 500, whatever, that that slope is a lot flatter than if you look at the way that GMs treat it when they make trades for draft picks. Their implied slope is really steep, which means that they're paying a really high premium for like the number one overall pick because they assign this meaning to it, and they have this idea that they can, you know, if given the chance to pick, they, of course, being infinitely wise, they will pick the right guy. I think what's interesting is that in the NBA, it is a lot steeper. Like the actual value curve of, you know, going down from the first pick throughout is really steep, which does seem to suggest there is actually a really big gap between, for instance, the performance historically of the number one overall pick and even the number two overall pick. That having that number one overall pick is a demonstrable advantage over any other pick in the draft, and it kind of goes, you know, steeply down even going through two and three and so on and so forth, that it does seem to suggest that, you know, this idea that franchise players are very identifiable at the top of the draft is more true in basketball than it is in football.
Yeah, so basically that's just saying if you have a high pick, you should stick with it more in the NBA because the likelihood of getting even two guys at, like, let's say 17th and 22nd and getting the equivalent of a number four pick is just not there the way it might be in football.
Yeah, and it's not additive the same way it is in the NFL where you can – there's so many roster spots and there's so many opportunities to kind of accumulate that surplus value across multiple players, whereas in the NBA, you can only have five guys on the court at one time, and there's so much value to having a lot of ability concentrated in one individual guy like a LeBron that, you know, it doesn't pay off to accumulate those lower picks.
It's like, do stars matter? We can just refer to that, too.
That's right.
Well.
That goes hand in hand, though, with what we found when we talked about that, is that in the NBA, stars matter far and away more than other sports.
And so if you have the chance at one, then you should take it, if perhaps they have bust potential like D'Angelo Russell. Mm-hmm. Okay, so
redlining like a car engine.
Yes,
okay.
I liked that metaphor. That was good, right? Yeah. Okay, so let's leave that there for now. Guys, I want to tell you a story. So walking through Brooklyn the other day on my way to work, I walked by a school that had this cart of books out from their library, end of year school free book sale kind of thing, take the book, whatever. And I had a feeling we would be talking about A-Rod on this podcast, and sure enough, there it is, Matt Christopher's On the Field with Alex Rodriguez, .. It was fate, kismet. So I want to start this segment with just an excerpt from Chapter 9, entitled Starting at the Top. This is from his 1996 season, his first full year in the big leagues after a couple years in and out. When Alex Rodriguez arrived at spring training, he looked like a new person. He had added pounds of muscle to his body without losing any flexibility or speed. He walked right up to manager Lou Piniella and spoke softly but firmly. "I'm ready," he said. Piniella looked him in the eye. He had never seen Rodriguez look so serious. "I know you are, son."
Wow.
So I bring that up because now when I read that, I like can't help but think about steroids. And this is what Alex Rodriguez has done to himself.
Fast but flexible.
Yes, exactly. Huh. Pounds of muscle. Huh. Like, I'm not sure that Matt Christopher is exactly the guy to expose Alex Rodriguez.
Is that fan fiction also?
That's a separate conversation about Matt Christopher, which we can do.
A different segment on the number of books he's written. Please.
Oh, it would. That is a hot take.
I was
going to
ask
sure.
if A-Rod was a Barry Stew in Matt Christopher's story.
Was that a deep cut Matt Christopher reference? Right
no,
there?
No, no. The, you know, Mary Sues and characters that are stand-ins for the author are unrealistically talented.
So that all seems very innocent now, what Matt Christopher's writing. And because of all that we know that came after he bulked up in the 1996 season, apparently. But it brings us also to what happened last week, which is that on Friday, Alex Rodriguez became the 29th person to hit 3,000 times, to get 3,000 hits in his career. It was a culmination, truly one of the strangest careers in Major League history. You have steroids, you have championships, you have centaurs or pictures of them above his bed. He's been the league's heel for years, and it makes our conversation about him really complicated and almost a proxy for our conversation about the steroids era in general. And you could hear a little bit about that when Eric Wedge commented on the 3,000th hit on Baseball Tonight over the weekend.
Now, because it's Alex Rodriguez, I get that, but you can't deny the performance. You can't deny what he's done over the course of his career.
So can we deny it, Neil? I mean, like, do we factor in steroids to his performance, or are the stats, and that's the tautology, and that's that?
I mean, if I knew the answer to that, I would be able to solve all of our Hall of Fame debates and just the eternal questions of how do you deal with the stats from this era, because, you know, as a sabermetrics guy, I have always been of the opinion that, you know, each era has its own defining, you know, attributes. For instance, before baseball was integrated, you had Babe Ruth facing off against, you know, not all of the staffs that he could have faced, you know, the pitchers that he could have faced. Satchel Paige could have pitched against him among many other great pitchers. And so do you ding Babe Ruth for that?
For baseball not being integrated?
Yeah, exactly, because he put up the numbers that, you know, taking advantage of the situation that he was handed. Of course, you can say, you know, Alex Rodriguez sort of made his own situation, but a lot of people during his era used performance-enhancing drugs. So in a certain sense, you want to just say the eras are what they are, and if you adjust to the league average each, you know, whatever season it is and whatever the conditions are, if you just adjust for the quality of competition that they faced and all of these things, then you can kind of put everyone in their place in Major League history, and you don't have to deal with the untidiness of steroids. But on the other hand, you do have this issue of, you know, do you believe Jose Canseco, who said that a substantial portion of the playing population used steroids, or do you kind of confine it only to things like the Mitchell report or the test that got leaked later of, you know, a small number of people used, and do you assume everyone else was clean? And I think that is really the issue, even beyond the idea that A-Rod sort of willingly broke the rules. If they were not the rules that were in place of Major League Baseball at the time, they certainly were against, you know, the law at certain points that he was using. And then he even broke them once they were against the rules of Major League Baseball. So sort of an unrepentant cheater. How do you deal with that, and how do you contextualize that in a sport that loves numbers and loves the at least the illusion that you can take Rogers Hornsby's numbers from, you know, the 19-teens and put them right up against Ken Griffey Jr. and A-Rod and Barry Bonds and make some kind of clean comparison. And maybe we're all naive, and this just exposed the idea that baseball could do that for what it really was, which was just a fantasy.
Yeah, I think that's kind of what it did, was baseball's love of being able to take any number and any stat from any era and have it hold true. And now you throw the wrench into it of how to quantify what steroids mean, and it blows that whole notion apart. I mean, this is the ultimate irony for baseball, is that it wants to name and quantify everything, and yet it can't quantify this one thing that is like a seeping dark cloud over all of baseball, and yet it's still trying to quantify it, right? It's still trying to say, we think you doped, we think you did steroids, we think you didn't, you get into the hall, you don't. It's the ultimate irony of baseball right now, is the quantifiableness, is a word I'm just going to say, of baseball, and yet this thing that you can't quantify. And I even said this, and I can't believe I said it on Around the Horn last week when we were talking about A-Rod, because I'm a Mets fan, and I'm not an A-Rod fan, but at some point, and we didn't do this when he hit the home run mark, at some point you have to stop and say, okay, can we just at some point parse out the baseball and honor him for some of that? Because it seems like there's just been years and years and years of never even stopping to really recognize some of what he's done in baseball and the achievements.
So I'm confused, because Neil, you have a piece on 538 right now in which you do normalize for the era that a player has played in. And in it, you note that A-Rod's 3,000 hits, if you normalize for the number of hits that are going on in that era that the player played in relative to average, et cetera, A-Rod is probably 48 hits ahead of where we'd expect him to be if he were playing at an average time. Is that a reasonable approximation of it?
Yeah.
And so to me, then, doesn't that take into account, I'm about to argue against myself once I get this out of my mouth, but doesn't that take into account the steroids era, quote unquote, and in a way quantify it relative to other baseball eras?
Yeah, to a certain extent. I mean, this is kind of a pure sabermetric solution to it, is just to say, well, let's look at what the league average of hits per plate appearance was and adjust for park and adjust for, you know, the overall environment in which he played. And I don't think that's really satisfying beyond just the numbers for their own sake necessarily, which was the purpose of the exercise. And you can kind of run that as a pure, you know, exercise. But there, the question of the ethics of using performance-enhancing drugs, I don't think is something that sabermetrics can ever really satisfactorily answer. And that's, you know, maybe that's a flaw, or maybe that's just something that sabermetrics was never really intended to do, because a lot of this comes down not just to, you know, the home runs that A-Rod hit had a certain amount of value, and that value can be quantified, and we can say how many Yankees and Mariners wins that he contributed to, and Rangers wins, although there were less of those. But we, you know, that is not satisfying because there's this moral aspect to it that transcends winning and losing for a lot of the people that are the gatekeepers for the Hall of Fame. They want to be able to assign a bigger meaning than just winning and losing, some kind of ethical meaning to your ability to hit home runs that, you know, is completely unsatisfied by any adjustments that you make without taking into account steroids.
So I have perhaps a too grand of a theory about this, which is that baseball, the ease that baseball has to quantify everything makes things feel empirical and therefore also makes things feel pure, and purity is morally good, right? And so what A-Rod did was, and Kate, maybe you're getting at this a bit before, he tainted the purity, not just of the game, but also of the stats for it. And that's actually his moral wrong.
And it's not just A-Rod. We should say Barry Bonds did this well before A-Rod and was you know, criticized for it.
But interestingly, go ahead.
But if cleanliness is next to godliness, right? There's a Christian reference on Hot Take Down for you, right? But then you think numbers are very clean. And A-Rod just muddied everything. But not just A-Rod, but you got to have one guy who takes the fall usually in the same way you did with cycling.
And interestingly, A-Rod is still playing in a way, and maybe it's just recency bias, but Bonds never quite got back to where he was after all the steroid stuff happened. Whereas A-Rod, what we're seeing now, A-Rod, I was looking the other day, has the fifth fewest softly hit balls in the majors this league among qualifying batters, which is nuts. He took a full year off of baseball, and he's still hitting the ball incredibly hard. And if you're a super sabermetrics guy and you believe that how hard a player hits a ball is really what you should be judging their skill by, not whether or not it falls for a hit or not, that's crazy that a guy can play, that can take a year off. And it gets back to the phenom nature of A-Rod and why it's such a tragedy if you believe in talent manifesting as it perhaps it naturally should, that he chose to resort to enhancements as opposed to letting that talent play out naturally.
Yeah, and I wrote something about this last year of, you know, it's somewhat likely, depending on when you believe A-Rod started using performance-enhancing drugs, and there are people out there that thought that he used them in high school, and certainly that, you know, the passage that you read with Lou Piniella was in 1996. He was a 20-year-old. It was in his first full MLB season. He could have been using then. We don't know, and maybe that's the problem, but if you take sort of the evidence that we do know that he certainly was using by the time he signed the mega contract with the Rangers, then he had the talent to be one of the best players ever. Looking at that 96 season that he had in particular, in which he hit 358, had 54 doubles, led the league, 36 home runs, and he would later go on to steal 46 bases in a season just a couple years later while hitting 42 home runs. So he had the talent to be an all-time great, not just a Hall of Famer, but in inner circle Hall of Famer. And so that's what kind of makes this especially tragic, is that he kind of threw all that away with the steroids.
Like you said, we don't know, and we don't know when A-Rod started using steroids. We don't know when the steroids started, so how do
you
even...
We don't know when anyone started.
When you talk about the stats and trying to normalize the stats, how do you know that you've even got the right time frame? That's why it's still muddied.
Well, that's something that you can never really normalize for. All you can really normalize for is notice that, hey, league-wide offensive levels went up and we're tracking, you know, we're devaluing your certain offensive events or your, you know, runs created according to that because they're less valuable in a higher run environment than they were in a lower run environment. And so you're kind of taking this position of almost like agnostic about steroids where you're saying, look, I don't care why the run environment has gone up. I'm just taking into account that it has and adjusting everyone accordingly to that, but you're not really ever taking steroids into account because, like you said, we don't know when anyone started. We don't know when the pitchers that A-Rod faced were using or not using, and we don't know when his, you know, fellow batters were using. So it really does muddy things in that way, and I think all you can really do statistically is just take a win is a win is a win in whatever era it is, and it just took more runs to create a win in the, you know, late 90s because of, you know, the home run explosion and the increased run environment than it does now when home runs are less prevalent and run scoring is down.
I'm going to selfishly give myself the last word on this, which is that what you just said, Neil, gets at what I was saying earlier, I think, which is that in baseball, you know everything too, because baseball is the game of outcomes where when a pitch comes in, it's either a swing or a hit or a ball or strike, right? There are only certain ways that a pitch can what happens when a pitch is pitched. And what the trick with the steroid era is, we don't know about it. And that's also what transgresses against baseball norms. And that's what taints the water as well. Kate, you want that last word.
I do, because now it's making me think about Pete Rose and mm-hmm. why baseball was so upset at him. Because
and we just found out this week that Rose was betting while he was a player, thanks to ESPN's
reporting
on it.
And in a way, that of course muddies the stats too, because you go into stats assuming everybody has this pure intention of wanting to play the game a certain way. And if you throw in gambling to the mix, then you don't, that pure intention is taken away, which is, I think, is one of the reasons why everyone in baseball has always been so upset about Pete Rose. And perhaps there's a correlation there to steroids, except instead of just being banished forever, now baseball has to kind of process A-Rod and deal with him going forward and having him in the game and not knowing how to feel.
I'm going to wrest that last word right back from you and just say that maybe
and then
this
after you're done, I have to...
and just say that maybe this suggests that we just need to deal with the fact that these are not perfect little environments of simulations
and, they never
and dice rolls.
Been.
Neil wants that last word.
That's
they
right.
never have and been, the, says the, Neil Payne. Okay, so let's leave it there and we'll all get the last word next time we talk about A-Rod. As always, at the end of our show, we bring in Allison McCann to bring us our significant digit of the week, a telling number in sports that says something larger, perhaps, about where a sport or an athlete is. Allison, welcome back to the show from LA.
Hey, Chad. Thanks for having me.
And what sig dig have you brought us?
Sort of in the not digit vein, but this week's is 1 minute and 42 seconds, which is the difference in time between Ronda Rousey's fastest win and her upcoming opponent, Beth Correa's fastest win in both of their last three fights. And I'm sure if you remember back in February when Rousey finished, who is the current UFC bantamweight champion, and she finished off Kat Zingano in about 14 seconds. And Beth Correa, on the other hand, her fastest win is a minute and 56 seconds. And there's been a fair amount of trash talking leading up to this August 1st fight, and it's just sort of hilarious to me that you can trash talk someone who is over a minute and a half better at just destroying people than you are. But I know Kate has some thoughts on sort of just women's sports trash talk in general, so I'll let you jump in on this note.
I do love the trash talking in the women's sports.
You were happy about Colombia trash talking the U.S. in soccer this week as well.
Yeah, I loved it. Even though they were setting up straw men and then tearing them down, because I don't think the U.S. ever really disrespected them. But I loved it because in the World Cup, specifically, there's a lot of matchups that you understand intrinsically, like U.S.-Germany, U.S.-China. There's some historical significance there. But U.S.-Colombia, not as much to like the casual observer. And then here came Colombia and made a bunch of headlines and kind of gave you storylines to dig into and talk about. And like, I love that whenever that happens in women's sports. And Ronda Rousey is an all-star at trash talking.
Yeah, it seems to be a good thing for journalists, you know, to be able to cover something with that kind of controversy and statements. But I wonder if it actually helps you. I do remember there being a lot more trash talk even in the NBA in the 90s, and someone like Gary Payton would almost like talk to himself, like he wasn't talking trash to even another player. He was just talking to like get himself going. And it seems like that could be a strategy if you feel like you're an underdog.
I don't know how much I love trash talking in the game, although I'm fine with it. I like when female athletes, instead of just playing like the role model, say the right thing, actually put out something with some meat on the bone that you
this
can talk
is before
about.
The
before
fight.
Just like I like it when female athletes at least just say what they're thinking and are okay to rock the boat. Because even radio hosts, I know when it Columbia U.S. game, were like, they weren't going to talk about it. And then Columbia says stuff and they're like, yeah, we're going to dig into that.
So have any of us, any of the four of us actually watched a USC match before?
Yeah, I watched it.
Yeah. Okay. Because I have not, and I have no interest in watching men fight, but Rousey's trash talk is part of the reason why, and just her figure, or her as a figure of sport and sort of interest, is one of the reasons why I would watch her fight and wouldn't watch the men fight. And this gets to your larger point, Kate, about narrative in women's sports, which is we don't have always the kind of narrative that we do in men's sports because the the feedback loop isn't set up to really drive all the narrative over and over again.
And another interesting thing to me, Allison, you pointed out this 1 minute and 42 second difference. That actually came from Rousey's own Instagram account. Is that right? Like, she was putting that out as almost like data analysis.
Ronda Rousey, for when Allison's on vacation, she should be our new significant digital offer.
That last fight, 14 seconds, at first you could say that it was bad for the UFC because people are paying and they're investing all this time to watch this fight, and then it's over in 14 seconds. But at the same time, the way that went viral afterward, because you could actually fit that fight into a Vine, was unlike anything else, unlike a 2 minute fight. So I think the way Ronda Rousey fights, and even when she absolutely destroys people at this point, is still good for UFC women.
Yeah, I was just back to Neil's point. I thought it was pretty interesting to see this Instagram photo of her, like, stat comparison that she was, you know, just being like, feel free to trash talk, but here are some numbers for you.
All right, so that'll do it for this week's show. Allison, thanks as always for trooping in from LA.
Thanks for having me.
And Kate Fagan, as always.
Thanks, Chad.
And Neil Payne, as always.
Thank you, Chad.
Our podcast producer is Jody Avergan. Our video producer is Ryan Antel. Our intern is Asta Chaturvedi. Once again, thanks to SeatGeek for sponsoring the show. Remember to use the promo code TAKEDOWN when buying tickets on the SeatGeek app. You can email us at contact@538.com. We'd love to hear what you think. You can find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Downcast, all sorts of other apps as well. We're on iTunes, of course. You can subscribe at itunes.com/538. While you're there, be sure to review and or rate the show. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. We'll talk to you next time.